Finance. Today we're going to be going through the new numbers for the North Star and start asking questions about this project. It's changed quite a bit over the last 6 months with the new federal transportation numbers that have come out, plus with the governor's proposal. I'm not sure that the committee members will get answers to all of our questions today. You're more than welcome to ask them. The NCDA and others have asked me to allow them to respond, and I feel that's fair since this has been changed in the last week. But please do ask the questions, and we will try to get answers before we take this issue up in our committee sometime after session starts. And at this time, we do not know what our committee deadline and when we'll have to get our bonding proposals out of the committee. But I expect it'll be sometime early to late February. I think it'll be probably moving that fast this year that we'll have to have our bonding recommendations to the bonding committee so they can spend their allotted time working on it. But none of that's been decided yet, so we'll have to go from there. Representative Tingelstad, would you like to make an introduction to the bill? And then we'll go to Bob McFarland. And to the committee, Mr. McFarland has asked that he be able to go through his presentation and then take questions at the end, so I'm going to try to allow that to happen. Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning, and I realize you're making a special effort to get in before session here, so that's I'm especially grateful for that opportunity. Today we have before us House File 1233, which was the bill that was submitted during the last legislative session. It is my intention to put together a new bill, which will probably get a bill number at the beginning of session this year, which will be the formal proposal that will be before you in this bonding session, and it will match the governor's recently released bonding numbers with that. Just as a sort of an introduction to this whole topic, I know you've heard a lot about it over the last several years, and I know you realize that the North Star Corridor between Minneapolis and up through the northern suburbs along Highway 10 to Big Lake and beyond, that area is a very fast-growing part of our state. In fact, there was an article a week ago Sunday on many of those communities in that area being the fastest growing in the state and actually in the country as well. And even though we haven't been able to put highway dollars towards that Highway 10 corridor, we're looking at other transportation alternatives. And what I've been impressed about with this North Star Commuter Rail project is that it's very cost effective and that it addresses a problem which can be completed ideally by 2008. And be one of the solutions for that corridor for dealing with the traffic congestion. Today I want to bring to your attention a couple items that are in your packet. A statement from Congressman Mark Kennedy, who is the congressman who represents most of that area through the North Star Corridor, in a release dated January 13th of his support and his intentions to seek the federal matching dollars, as well as Senator Norm Coleman in his release dated January 13th. So with that, Mr. Chair, I don't want to take a lot of committee time because I know there's some valuable presentations here with lots of new information which helped Governor Pawlenty decide to support this project. So thank you for your committee time, and I look forward to questions at the end of the presentation.
Thank you. Mr. McFarland.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. We have a presentation today that's in four parts. I will be talking and presenting to the committee the report from the North Star Working Group that the legislature created at the end of the 2003 legislative session. That report is in front of you. Then I will present to you the basics of the governor's proposal that was released last week. Members of the North Star Corridor Development Authority and the experts in this process will give you a brief presentation about the federal process and how the project is being analyzed and what happens from this point forward. And we also have Mr. Cliff Green, who is the state's negotiator and the person who is working with Burlington Northern Santa Fe to reach agreement and consensus with Burlington Northern on improvements in that corridor. So if I may, Mr. Chairman, and again, you have the work group report in front of you. Again, the North Star Work Group was created by the 2003 legislature to provide the legislature updated numbers on certain aspects of the North Star Corridor. There were 22 staff-level members of the work group that came from the Department of Transportation, North Star Corridor Development Authority, the Metropolitan Council, and representatives from the counties in the corridor. We were focused on providing the legislature objective data on some of the key elements of this project that were outlined in the law, and the law is in Appendix A of your report. This report of the work group effort was not intended to answer all questions about North Star. It was not a forum for debating the merits of commuter rail in general or the North Star project in particular, but to answer specific questions put to it by the legislature. The data we focused on in the work group was to update ridership projections by using 2000 census data, update and get information from the Burlington Northern Santa Fe on their estimates for improvements that are necessary in the corridor and operating issues. And we started our process initially focused on the previously proposed 82-mile Rice to Minneapolis line. A good bit of our work was done under that presumption. I can talk about the ridership projections that that we worked on in the group. I think it's very important to understand that through the combination of the work group's effort and Governor Pawlenty's work with the Federal Transit Administration, we learned early on in the process that the federal modeling process for analyzing commuter rail projects had changed significantly. Therefore, the effort to update ridership projections and other data was far more complex than simply plugging in new census numbers. It had a dramatic impact on this project and the projections. The Federal Transit Administration, and you'll learn more about this from the NCDA folks who will talk later, they are now focused on what's called a cost effectiveness index. And in that modeling methodology, emphasizing ridership or maximizing ridership is de-emphasized, and cost effectiveness is the new measure, and that might not necessarily maximize ridership in the modeling process. So what's really important to understand is that from where the legislature ended in 2003 and the projections it had in front of it for ridership to where it is today, those are apples to oranges comparisons. You cannot compare the previous model results with the current model results and where this project sits. First and foremost, the project was shortened by from Rice to Minneapolis to a new 40-mile segment, Big Lake to Minneapolis, to meet the new cost-effectiveness criteria put forth by the Federal Transit Administration. And here's a map, and it's in your packet at the end of the summary, just to give you kind of a geographic look at this corridor, the original line from Rice to Minneapolis, and then about halfway you see the Big Lake Station. This is an older map of the corridor, and as you will learn later, even some of the stations south of Big Lake towards Minneapolis that are shown on this map have been eliminated from the proposal to meet the cost effectiveness index. So let's walk through the ridership projections. Under the previous Federal Transit Administration model, where the legislature ended in 2003, those ridership projections were based on 1990 census data for the project Rice to Minneapolis. And at the time the working group was put together, that ridership projection was 10,800 one-way trips per day in the corridor by the year 2020. This is the number the legislature was asking the work group to update. Under that previous FTA model, simply updating that model with 2000 census data, Rice to Minneapolis again, the larger project, that number or the projection increased to 15,800 one-way trips per day in the year 2025. That's the direct update from the number you had asked for. However, under the current FTA model that is now the subject or the controlling model for the project, you have 2,000 census data. Now the project is Big Lake to Minneapolis. The ridership projection is 5,600 one-way trips per day in the year 2025. And this is the projection that is in the new Federal Transit Administration submittal for the project. Now later, when we have the NCDA folks here talking about the FTA process, they can explain to you a bit more the differences between the previous model and the current model. Has largely to do with what types of riders are allowed to be counted in the corridor. And they'll give you a little bit more detail on that. But the new ridership projection for the project Big Lake to Minneapolis, 5,600 one-way trips per day. The other charge of the work group was to work with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe to seek from them updates on their estimates of improvements necessary in the corridor to accommodate commuter rail. I want to stress very much that the Burlington Northern Santa Fe staff, both here and from across the country, was extremely cooperative with the work group effort. They are a partner in this project. We are not at odds. There was a mutual understanding between the Burlington Northern Santa Fe staff and the work group and the North Star Commuter or Corridor Development Authority staff about differences in estimates, what they mean, where the different parties are coming from. There's a mutual understanding there. It's also understood by all the parties involved in these discussions that the absolute final estimates for capital improvements and for operating costs will not be known until discussions with BNSF are completed and the final design phase is completed, which is what the governor has proposed. One of the things we did work out and the work group has identified are the capital and operating cost ranges between different estimates. So we have a better understanding of where the differences are and the dollar amounts that are associated with those differences. With the Burlington Northern Santa Fe provided to the working group an update on their estimates of the improvements, the capital improvements that are needed in the corridor. When we went through this exercise with them, we were still talking about the Rice to Minneapolis line. Their previous estimate, again, the number that was on the table when the legislature adjourned in 2003, was $134 million for track and signal improvements in the corridor. That was an estimate that was put forth by BNSF in the late 1998, early 1999 time frame. At the same time, the North Star Corridor Development Authority's estimate for similar improvements or for improvements for track and signal in the corridor was $70 million. So there was a difference between the two parties of about $64 million. BNSF provided us an update to their estimate. And again, we were talking Rice to Minneapolis. It involves 19 track and signal improvements. There was little change from their previous estimate to the estimate provided to the working group. It actually went down a little bit. Their new estimate to the working group was $132.2 million for the improvements they feel are necessary. And again, those are in 2004 dollars. Near the end of our work as a working group, we worked with BNSF to adjust their Rice to Minneapolis estimate to fit the Big Lake to Minneapolis line that emerged late in the process. BNSF helped direct us through this extrapolation from their previous estimate, and these charts are shown in the work group report. We adjusted their estimate by eliminating or adjusting improvements that were on the list from Big Lake North, and we came to the current estimate of capital improvements, Big Lake to Minneapolis, of $103.3 million. Those are in 2004 dollars. It should be noted that of that amount, there is a contingency. It's included in that amount of about $12.5 million. The current NCDA estimate under the new FTA criteria that matches the new BNSF estimate, Big Lake to Minneapolis, is about a little bit over $51 million in 2004 dollars. So the range of the difference of opinion at this point, and again working on this in a very cooperative manner, is about $52 million. Again, the discussions are ongoing with BNSF in a very cooperative environment. We expect resolution with BNSF. We would not be in discussions with BNSF if we did not expect that some of the differences of opinion or perspective could be worked out. But all the parties also understand that the costs for this project and the cost for the capital improvements must stay in line with the Federal Transit Administration's cost effectiveness index criteria. We did talk with BNSF about operating costs for the line. I should note that the estimates on annual operating costs are not a large item of discussion or dispute to this point with BNSF. There are not major differences. There are some differences in estimates of certain things. BNSF reviewed the North Star Development Authority's list of estimates for operating costs, found that list to be comprehensive. They offered some updates to the items that are directly related to their operations, and they were fairly minor changes. So this was not a big area of dispute. Currently, the operating estimate for the Big Lake to Minneapolis line, and this is the NCDA estimate, is $10.3 million a year running four-car train sets. There's also $9.7 million a year if you run three-car train sets. Differences, minor differences with BNSF over some of the operating costs are being discussed with BNSF. The $9.7 to $10.3 million estimate compares to the previous annual operating cost estimate of $13.4 million a year. One of the issues the work group talked about and that was brought up a good bit was an issue that's within the operating costs, and that is risk and liability. Who bears the risk and the liability for operation of commuter rail? It's a complicated issue. There has been a work team is being put together involving MnDOT staff, NCDA staff, Minnesota Department of Administration staff, and their insurance experts, and the State Attorney General staff. Some of the issues that came up regarding risk and liability and some of the questions that need to be addressed are the nature of the federal limit on liability that's spelled out in Amtrak law and how that relates to commuter rail operations. If the state assumes liability for the operations of commuter rail, what's the role of the state tort liability limit? There is talk about a national commuter rail liability pool that may come forward, and then just generally who's covered by what. While it's a complicated issue, it is an issue that has been worked out satisfactorily in other communities, in other corridors throughout the country. The BNSF has asked, as they also have asked in Seattle and in other operations, that the state cover $200 million per incident in liability coverage for the operation of commuter rail. The current estimate for cost of that coverage, and it's part of the operating cost estimate, is $1.3 million a year. So it's not a make or break issue in terms of cost, but there are some issues that need to be ironed out to make sure that the risk and liability issue is spelled out satisfactorily and the questions are answered. Mr. Chairman, that completes the quick review of the work group report, and if I may move in and use this as a segue into the governor's proposal.
Go ahead.
Before we get into the governor's, what the governor has proposed, Mr. Chairman, just to provide a little bit of additional background information that was not specifically covered under the work group report and the work group effort. I think the committee should know that currently the cost estimate for the Big Lake to Minneapolis line as being submitted to the Federal Transit Administration by the Corridor Development Authority is $265 million in 2007 dollars, $265 million total cost. Under the Federal Transit Administration cost effectiveness index criteria that generates a cost effectiveness index of $24.80 per hour. And again, that will be the details of what that means will be described coming up here. What's important to know at this point of the presentation is that the project has generating a cost effectiveness index below the Federal Transit Administration's $25 soft threshold for analyzing these projects. It is considered under that criteria to be a good project nationwide. Also to remind the committee, and I'm sure you've heard this before in discussions about North Star, federal funds are expected to cover 50% of the total project cost. So with that, Mr. Chairman, talking about the governor's proposal that was released last week. I don't think it's any surprise or it's not new information to the members of this committee that in previous years, Governor Pawlenty has been skeptical to opposed to commuter rail and the North Star Commuter Rail project. In August of 2002, as the project continued to receive further analysis by a number of entities, the governor indicated an openness to further analysis and consideration of the North Star project. After being elected governor, he called for an objective review of the project, of the numbers, and to update project data like was being done in the work group effort. And he indicated his desire for that information was because he was skeptical of previous analysis and number crunching that was done by other entities. The governor indicated that he was going to rely very heavily on an unbiased, rigorous, and critical review by the Federal Transit Administration. And the governor drove that process very strongly throughout the summer, with extensive personal involvement in discussing this project with Federal Transit Administration staff and with the Federal Transit Administration administrator on a personal basis. The governor was very involved in driving this objective review and analysis of this project. And following that rigorous scrutiny and extensive review of the project himself, the governor came to the conclusion that the project was worthy of further consideration and investment by the state. He sees this as a new option, and a valuable option, not a complete solution, but an option to serve the transportation needs of a growing congested corridor in our region. It meets the federal criteria, very conservative, critical, strict, rigorous federal criteria under the new model, and it has local and regional, and as Representative Tingelstedt pointed out, congressional delegation support. So the governor has proposed for the state to provide sufficient non-federal financial commitment to secure the Federal Transit Administration's approval to move this project to its next stage, or the final design stage. He has proposed that the state provide $37.5 million in general obligation bonding in this legislative session. And that bonding, or release of that bonding, would be contingent upon a matching $37.5 million in local government funding from local governments in the corridor to fund this portion of the project. The governor has proposed that total cost responsibility be split in the following way. We know that the federal government share will be 50% of the project. He is proposing that the remaining 50% of the project be then split 50-50 between the state and the local units of government in the corridor, which leads us to 50% federal, or an estimated $132.5 million. 33% of the total cost would be borne by the state, $88.3 million. And 16.7% of the total cost would be borne by local entities in the corridor, or $44.2 million. For operating cost responsibility, for the costs that are not covered by farebox revenues or other federal dollars that might be available for operating costs, the governor is proposing a 50-50 split between the state and the local entities in the corridor that is consistent with the legislature's passage of the operating cost model for the Hiawatha Light Rail Line last session. Details behind the governor's proposal. The Federal Transit Administration requires that a project have at least 50% of the non-federal share of the total estimated cost of the project committed before it will allow the project to move forward into the final design phase. Again, the current cost estimate for the project is $265 million. The non-federal share of that estimate is $132.5 million. Therefore, the minimum non-federal commitment to move to final design would be approximately $66.5 million. The $75 million that is being proposed is more than sufficient in non-federal funding to secure federal approval to go to final design. The one thing you should know is that the Federal Transit Administration will be presenting a report to Congress within the next couple of months about New Start's projects. This project will receive a rating from the Federal Transit Administration of not rated, simply because the state's share, or this non-federal funding share, will not have been identified or committed yet. Once that is committed by the 2004 legislature under the governor's proposal, the Federal Transit Administration will change its recommendation, or so we expect, to recommended status for final design. It's also important to note that only a portion of the $75 million that becomes committed will actually be spent in the final design process. The final design cost estimate is about $20 million. That would be split 50% federal, 50% non-federal. The major expenses for this project will be spent following the final design process and following the state reaching agreement with the Federal Transit Administration on what's called a full funding grant agreement. So while the federal process requires half of the non-federal share to move forward, that's a demonstration of support from the state. Not all that money will be committed, and not all that money will be spent in the final design process. Also in final design, the right-of-way acquisition process will begin, and the rolling stock procurement process will begin. That begins at the same time the final design begins, so we can stay on track for opening the line late in 2008. Final design process itself will take about 18 months. The governor has been very clear in his proposal that he anticipates that the total cost estimate will rise. Being very upfront, he anticipates it will rise, but within the known ranges that have been identified by the working group. They will rise because of things like the discussions with the Burlington Northern, further work on operating costs, as the final design process solidifies estimates. It must be very clear that we expect those to rise. And as the project goes through the final design process, and as those estimates rise as anticipated, the project will be further analyzed. It can be found after the final design process to be cost prohibitive. This is an incremental process. If you get to the point where you simply cannot get costs in line with the Federal Transit Administration's cost effectiveness index, they may choose not to recommend it for further federal funding, or the state may choose not to go forward. So there is another step in this process in the future for the state to analyze the cost effectiveness of this project. And I want to also point out that under current operation cost estimates, the state share of annual operating costs would be in the range of $3 to $5 million a year. Now, I put that cost estimate together based on a number of factors, and I would tell you that that's on the high end of the range. It's the high end of the range. When you take a look at how operating costs would be covered by other federal funds, fare boxes and such, we'll want to be cautious on the operating side as opposed to overly optimistic. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the governor, in conclusion, the governor has repeatedly stated in a lot of different forums that he will support transportation projects that cost-effectively serve the primary transportation purpose of moving people from where they are to where they want to go, and do so in a timely fashion, be that mode highways, transit, and as the governor likes to say, rickshaws or Star Trek transporters. He has put this project through rigorous scrutiny, and he believes that under the new North Star Commuter Rail proposal, it meets his cost effectiveness criteria and his criteria for effective transportation service. The governor firmly believes that the legislature should move this project to the next level of consideration. He wants this project to be funded for final design and to secure Federal Transit Administration approval. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer questions about the work group process or the governor's proposal.
Mr. McFarland, on slides 28 and 29, there seems to be a conflict. You're entering final design, you're beginning right-of-way acquisition, you're beginning to buy the trains, and then in 29, the governor is saying you're going to final design where it could be cost prohibitive, and then back out. How can you back out after you gone, bought right-of-way and the trains?
On the right-of-way, for example, we've done this for highway projects, for example. There are circumstances where you may identify right-of-way that you would need for a potential project, begin the process of acquiring that right-of-way, which, you know, Mr. Chairman, takes a significant amount of time. Then the project can change. The right-of-way acquisition may change. Parcels may be returned to owner. Parcels that have been secured may be returned to owners, or the process may stop at a certain point. So you can begin the process of right-of-way, and as a project changes or a project ends, that process essentially can be reversed. In terms of procurement, I would like, if Ken Stevens or one of the NCDA folks could address a little bit about the rail car procurement.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The rail car procurement actually begins with the development of specifications for both the passenger coaches and the locomotives. And that is actually part of the final design, and I believe that is the part of the process that would be begun during final design. As opposed to actually placing orders that cause the cars to be constructed and so forth. So you develop the outline specifications, determine the details for the equipment that would work in our climate and under our conditions, and do that engineering work.
Still sounds like there's quite a commitment to that is going to be made, and it's going to be hard for the state to back out once it has invested these dollars.
Mr. Chairman, I
next wanted, to impossible.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think it is fair to acknowledge your comment there. It is unusual. It would be unusual for a project to go through the final design phase and then later be rejected. The scrutiny to get to final design is so rigorous that so I don't want to mislead the committee. There are few examples of a project that goes through final design and then is abandoned or rejected. The governor fully believes the project will meet scrutiny through the final design process.
Well, the governor also stated that he expects costs to rise. Your CEI is now at $24.80. The maximum is a soft 25. You only have 20 cents there to deal with. It seems like you're pushing the envelope now. How are you going to stay within federal guidelines on this portion of the from Big Lake into Minneapolis, realizing the governor thinks the costs are going to go up?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you're correct. The margin for cost increases as this project moves through final design is not very large. The Federal Transit Administration indicated to the governor that 25 is their guideline. They analyze projects on a lot of other issues, as you will hear in a moment, and it is not a hard threshold. As I mentioned, it's a soft threshold, and projects above 25 can receive Federal Transit Administration approval.
Every $1 million of this process, this increases in cost, what does that do to the CEI rating? Is it 5 cents, 10 cents to the cost of it?
Roughly a dime. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stevens tells me that it's roughly, for every million increase, it's roughly a dime or so increase in the CEI.
Do you have a $2 million increase to stay within a soft estimate? And well, Mr. McFarland, when we're working with the BNSF, I mean, even if you take that halfway, which is, 50-some million, you're talking 26 million, so you're talking 26 cents to 27 cents over what we're at here. Oh wait, no, it'd be more than that. It'd be $2 and something.
And we'll and that'll be
excuse my math.
Yeah, that'll be Mr. Chairman. That'll certainly be calculated as we go forward. And clearly, one of the values of the work group process is that all of the parties better understand what the thresholds are, what the project is shooting for in terms of cost effectiveness, and everybody has a better idea of what kind of make or break points, and the governor is confident that through the final design process we can work these things out and keep the project cost effective.
Mr. McFarland, I don't want to get ahead of you, and Mr. Stevens or one of the next ones will be going through this. I want to know exactly what was dropped from the proposal, what the costs were of those stations, especially from Big Lake, but also from the Big Lake to St. Cloud. And I don't know if you want to go through another presentation before you answer those, or
that will be part of
the next
NCDA's
presentation
in detail. Yes.
Representative Beard, you had a question.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. McFarland. Of the $75 million or $37.5 million the Plante administration has asked us for, about how much of this are we going to have to spend to get beyond the firm go, no-go point, where we either take off or abort?
Approximately, as I mentioned, the estimate for the final design process is about $20 million. That does not include the beginning of the right-of-way process or the procurement process. If you split that 20-50-50 between the federal and non-federal share, of the $75 million, approximately $10 million would be part of the final design process.
Mm-hmm.
I'd leave it to Mr. Stevens to talk a bit about how much in terms of the right-of-way process, because there are different mixes in terms of the federal dollars. Eventually, in the final analysis, the project comes out 50% federal, 50% state, but that 50-50 split doesn't apply to all individual elements of the project. So Ken, I don't know if you can offer any insight into how much can be covered under estimates of cost of procurement and right-of-way.
Sure.
Mr. Stevens.
Mr. Chairman and members, the federal and non-federal share is essentially 50-50 on the right-of-way procurement as well as the design that's been discussed at this point. Some of the right-of-way activities that would be involved, as you might expect with a progress or a project like this, as it becomes more widely known, and as you can see what's already happening here, is that developers become very interested in acquiring properties in and around the station sites, and the it becomes a matter of the time to purchase at the most prudent price, and that would be sooner rather than later. The interesting thing about right-of-way purchases, however, is, as Mr. McFarland has alluded to, is that they're not irreversible decisions. If you do acquire the property around the station area and it is determined that the project does not move forward, you still have the value of the property, and it's been the experience in locally as well as nationally, property values are not going down. Particularly in this fast-growing corridor that we're talking about here. Property values are increasing at a pretty rapid rate, so you do have that advantage. In addition to that, as has been experienced in this corridor already, we have seen bus service that's utilizing some of the same locations that would be utilized for a commuter rail project. So those park and rides are in place and are functioning as park and rides and as bus transit service.
Mr. Stevens, to that point, when you're acquiring right away, you know, I'm more familiar with, and I wish Representative Junkie was here, say you're doing a right away for a road and you're putting in a new intersection, that right away becomes very expensive because of the intersection that's going in there. The right-of-way along this line, I would expect to be very expensive because they think that this train is going to go there. The train does not go there. It seems like the right-of-way would not be as such a cash cow when it comes time to sell it if that train doesn't happen. I think MnDOT's found that out.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, the right-of-way that we're talking about acquiring in this corridor is principally at park and ride locations. As you all know, the right-of-way for the project to run the commuter rail train on is already owned by the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, and their tracks are already in place. So essentially, the right-of-way is for the park and ride lots at the station locations, and as we get later on in the presentation, we'll show those station locations, and if there are any questions about specific park and ride lots, I'd be happy to talk about those.
That's fair. Representative Beard, do you have a follow-up?
It was a simple question, Mr. Stevens. What I'd be interested in knowing is, what is the downside risk we're going to put the taxpayers at if we push this thing up the tracks and then decide to pull it back? Just about what that number is would be sufficient for my purposes today.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative, it seems to me like the absolute would be the final design number at $20 million, and half of that is non-federal, so local and state share would be the $10 million to complete the final design would be necessary to put in the project at the minimum.
Thank you. That's helpful to know.
Thanks. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, to the Governor's representative, I'm very grateful that the Governor made such a strong statement this morning that from now on, we will apply that same cost-effectiveness index to every transportation project, regardless of whether it is road or transit, because that, I think, for some of us has been a frustration for some time. We've spent enormous time scrutinizing two transit projects while spending billions all across the state on other transportation projects. And to know that they'll all be subjected to that same cost-effectiveness index now, I think, is very, very welcome news and assures the taxpayer that every dollar of transportation money will, in fact, be well spent and won't be spent based on local politics or something like that. The one problem I see with the numbers that we're seeing on the rail project is, if we could go way back to those first highway projects, we know there would have been some, like, one-time startup costs. I can't think of what they might be, the buildings where you store the sand for something or the maintenance equipment. In this case, we haven't talked a lot about that, but the first lines bear so much of that one-time startup cost, purchase of equipment, the station that maintains the cars. How do we, to be fair, we really have to acknowledge that, and how do we get at that, that this first line bears the cost for a lot of subsequent lines?
Mr. Stevens and Mr. McFarland, or is that coming up in the presentation later?
Mr. Chair, it really is not coming up in our presentation. Certainly there is a cost of first lines for a maintenance facility in the North Star Corridor. Cost estimate, the maintenance facility is roughly $30 million of the total cost. And that is for a minimal maintenance facility, because on this project, as with if there are subsequent commuter rail projects, most of the heavy maintenance is contracted out to people that are in the industry that already have the capability to repair locomotives, for instance, or fix damaged passenger coaches. The maintenance facility that's proposed for this project is really one that serves to support the fueling, the sanding, the washing of cars, the cleaning, the grooming of cars, and the routine maintenance that would go on day to day, safety inspections and small minor repairs. But it still is a substantial part of the project cost at about $30 million.
And the purchase of cars, did I hear you say?
The purchase of cars, the fleet that would be proposed for this project is designed to accommodate the forecast ridership, and so it wouldn't be providing cars for subsequent lines. If there, some of the spare equipment could serve other lines, but essentially the fleet requirement, 5 locomotives, 12 passenger coaches, and 6 cab cars, cab car being the car at the end of the train so the train can operate in each direction, would be required to provide the service that's proposed for this project.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hausman.
When you say it serves ridership for this group, but the point is, you know, some of that shrinking of the line now, let's say it went another 10 miles or 20 miles, you wouldn't buy more engines or cars. I think that was the piece I was trying to get at. Not this line, but an extension. When we first used to talk about this line, we actually talked about an Elk River to Hastings line. That was when MnDOT studied all of those original Elk River was what we were talking about. So we always acknowledged that there were some areas that had more intense ridership. But the other thing I heard you say that troubled me just a bit, because I hope North Star advocates aren't thinking in these terms, but you said, if we build another line, and I just think the picture we have of this region at the start of a project is so important. If we had only built one highway in this state, that highway wouldn't work. We knew that a road system had to be a whole system of all sorts of levels of roads, and they work together. And the same we know to be true of transit. We always said if we only built the LRT line, it would be a failure. But that we're assuming now there is in this metropolitan area going to be a system of roads that work well and a system of transit that works well. And that part of how we designed the North Star Corridor, I hope, is how it would serve the whole region. And, you know, for us to always acknowledge those sorts of, that overlay of other principles about this, it seems to be so important. Because we don't do North Star right if we don't think that later it's going to be a part of a system that serves the whole region.
Representative Hausman, you just step ahead of the chair. The forward-thinking chairs, Krinke and Queasley, are having a joint hearing next week to discuss all the proposals that are out there for rail and to get those on the table so we can look at those. So that will be a hearing next Tuesday, I believe, a joint hearing between the Capital Investment Committee and the Transportation Finance Committee. So your comments will be Very much appreciated, Dan. Mr. McFarland.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, I greatly appreciate your earlier comment or your compliment, and I hate to talk you away from it a little bit. But I just want to make sure that the committee understands that the Cost Effectiveness Index is a Federal Transit Administration measurement, not a MnDOT measurement. It is a measurement they use in their modeling for analyzing commuter rail and other rail new starts projects. Now, under the MnDOT's new statewide transportation plan, which I would imagine at some point the committee may hold a hearing on, we do have an extensive cost-benefit analysis process for analyzing highway projects that I think will provide you the same kind of comfort, but I didn't want to leave the committee with the impression that you will see cost-effectiveness index numbers for highway projects. That's a federal number.
Ms. McFarland, I think it was Mr. Stevens, maybe it's better directed to him, piggybacking off what Representative Hausman was saying, was that you would not need more cars or more trains if the ridership increased. What are you, if I am understanding the numbers you've given us, the ridership is at the new federal guidelines. You're probably purchasing trains for that amount of ridership. So if the ridership increases, you have to purchase additional trains?
Mr. Chairman and members, we have included in our proposal and in our cost estimates the fleet of equipment that I previously described. That will allow us to run four car trains. That is the same number of cars that we had previously included in our earlier estimate of higher ridership of 10,800. As we have been working with the FTA and as we have looked at our new ridership forecast, and then we further developed the ridership forecast into peak period trips, there was a concern on the part of the FTA that we, and I think Mr. McFarland also noted, we looked at a scenario of three car trains and four car trains. As we were working with FTA, trying to maintain the most cost-effective project, we initially dropped to three car trains. They raised a concern about the load factor, saying that in essence with the three car trains the load factors were actually over 100% as we neared our final destination in downtown, and suggested that we go back to the four car trains so that we could provide a seat for all commuter rail passengers. Now, interestingly enough, and maybe I'm getting too much into this, but with our new ridership forecast of 5,600 being roughly half of what the prior forecast was and roughly a third of what the old model would have predicted, it seems to us to be prudent to err on the side of having more capacity rather than less. We think if the ridership, since it is a forecast, has a much greater probability of exceeding the new forecast than being less than the new forecast. So we would have the capacity for additional riders, but and therefore we would have the capacity to for some modest extensions. And if there were to be other corridors, other lines, of course, we would have to analyze the forecast and analyze our capacity to see if we did need to add cars to the trains. I would like to just add, though, that the stations, as proposed, do provide for extensions to five-car trains without any additional expense. The platform lengths would accommodate a five-car train or a 25% increase in capacity. The locomotives also are able to pull up to 10-car trains, and each of the stations are located in areas that could be expanded, where the platforms could be expanded to accommodate those much longer trains. Although we are starting out, as I indicated, with a system that supports the forecast ridership.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McFarland, I have a number of questions. Could you clarify the roles of the NCDA and MnDOT in this working group? And I hope in the near future that you provide the committee with a list of the 22 members, their roles, and who they are representing. But mean, how did this work? Who paid for what? Who is actually making the applications to the FTA? You know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fulberg, the working group, the legislation is in Appendix A of your packet. The list of working group members is also in your packet. The issues that the legislature asked the working group to address was spelled out in the legislation. There were no state dollars expended for consultants per the direction of the legislation. What we found ourselves in also as a working group is that there were concurrent activities going on during the summer. The working group was focused on its piece of the work over the summer and kind of narrowly focused on its issues, while at the same time the NCDA and the governor were talking with the Federal Transit Administration and preparing a new starts proposal and developing a new proposal under the new model that the FTA had put forth. So there were kind of these concurrent things going on, some of which provided the working group the information it was seeking on behalf of the legislature. So I don't know if that answers your question, but you know, the working group stayed narrowly focused on its issues, while at the same time the governor was discussing the project in a broader sense with the Federal Transit Administration. Federal Transit Administration had indicated to the governor that the project needed to be run through this new model, and that process was going on. Since the NCDA is the legal entity putting forth that proposal, you know, they ran the new model and new numbers, and some of that work was presented to the work group to answer its questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. McFarland, isn't it true that our state statute's not in the one that you have here in our booklet, but prohibits MnDOT from expending funds to study commuter rail unless the money is expressly designated for that purpose?
Madam Chair, I believe so. Or Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I believe so. And we followed that law. We did not expend, other than doing the work and the staff time and the administrative stuff that was specifically asked for from the legislature in the work group process, which I would take as, you know, request to do the work. We did not, it was the NCDA's dollars and federal dollars that ran the project through the new modeling process.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, Mr. McFarland, was there money appropriated by the legislature to support studying of commuter rail by MnDOT?
There was no money appropriated by the legislature specifically for working group activities, which is the only activity that that state dollars would have been spent on. That is correct.
All right, thank you.
There was not a line item, no.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair and Mr. McFarland, can you explain the disparity of the numbers between screen number 24 and now number 25, where we talk about $75 million and the 50-50, and then also share with us if we're going to spend up to $20 million in final design and $10 million being the state and local share, what percentage of the $10 million will be state and what percentage will be local?
If I can answer the second question.
Go ahead.
In terms of that share of the 50% non-federal share of the final design between state dollars and local dollars, now, I simply gave you the figure of the non-federal share, $10 million. You could apply, and we could apply to that process the governor's the governor's split or proposed split of 50% of the non or 50% of the non-federal share. Oh, we have two-thirds, one-third, right? I'm sorry, two-thirds of the non-federal share borne by state funds and one-third of that $10 million borne by local funds, which is what the governor has proposed for the entire project. And now I want to get to your, I wasn't following your first question, which numbers you feel Representative Polberg is not in.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. McFarland, let's go back to the second question that you took first. You used the term "we could." What is the plan? I mean, when I look at Hiawatha and the mess we're in now, we didn't spell things out. We didn't know where operating funds were coming from. We didn't know how it was going to work. So in this proposal, if the governor has reviewed everything and knows how this is going to work, how is that $10 million going to be split? Split it two-thirds, one-third. We could split it 10%, 90%, or we could have a state do it all. What's the plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I don't have a final figure for you. I will get that. We will get that to you when we have that worked out.
Mr. McFarland, maybe a better question would be the final agreement between NCDA and the MnDOT. How much of the detail will be spelled out in that, and when will that be done? When we get down to the details of what gets paid for by whom and all of that, or it's one-third, two-thirds, or it's 50-50 of the upfront cost, when will that agreement be signed, and when will the legislature be able to look at that agreement? That's basically what you're asking.
It helps.
I have two ahead of you. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Stevens may have a better answer than
okay.
I can give you that.
Mr. Chairman and members,
take answers from anybody.
The question, if I understand it, is what will be the arrangement for going forth within final design? And the answer would be, assuming the legislation passes, that the arrangement would be two-thirds of the not. That decision is based, of course, upon legislation passing that does provide the non-federal share so that we can get approval from the FTA to begin final design. Until the action by the legislature commits sufficient non-federal funding, or local, if you will, funding, we are not going to get a recommendation to begin final design. So the action of the legislature comes before we begin the final design, and of course, based on the governor's proposal, that is two-thirds state and one-third NCDA.
Mr. Stevens, that runs contrary to what the governor has said, that the 50-50 will be the upfront cost, and the NCDA will be spending theirs first, or with the state. So how can you go to the two-thirds, one-third, when the governor's already stated that the initial stuff will be 50-50. There's, you know, and this is part of the agreement, but I'm wondering if the administration and NCDA has even started thinking about how they're going to do all this to make it work. Because the governor has stated time and time again that it's a 50-50 split on the first $75 million, but then all of a sudden we hear you're going back to two-thirds, one-third. Not quite making sense, so that might be some of the confusion.
Mr. Chair, I know we're going to have more hearings on this, and I don't want to spend a ton of time, but I mean, these are questions that need to be asked, and we need to have answers for. Instead of this, we could, we maybe, we will. I'm curious as far as cost overruns, how they'll be handled, if there'll be all at the local level, or if the state will be held accountable for cost overruns. Because we're talking about that we're anticipating that the costs will rise. And Mr. McFarland, as long as you're here from the administration, and I watched the coverage of the press conference related to this, and the governor stated that this was a high-density corridor. Can you tell me the criteria that he uses to determine a corridor high density?
I think when Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, taking a look at the population growth in the corridor, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, traffic growth projected both on 94 and Highway 10 in that corridor, those are the types of things. And there are other high-density corridors and corridors with transportation needs as well. This corridor in particular provides a rail line and an opportunity that the governor finds attractive.
Mr. Chair, I would like that information of what his criteria is for high density and what the requirements are for future development in that way. If we're going into high density transit oriented development, I'm curious to find out what the governor's standard for that is, and that given that we're going outside the seven county metro area, what standards he's going to use to ensure that level of density in order to support this type of transit corridor, and what tools that he's going to use to force the locals to rise to that standard of density that he's talking about being an important element of supporting this project. Can you talk to me about the light rail expansion as part of this, what the percentage, what the dollar costs are related to that, and how the funding works for that part, whether the feds pay that part or we pay it? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, there is a connection of less than a half a mile between the ending point of the Hiawatha light rail line and the ending point in Minneapolis for this commuter rail line. That is part of the $265 million cost estimate, and it's estimated in the range of $32 million. It would fall under the 50% federal, 50% non-federal split.
And, Mr. Chair, then for clarification purposes, then would it also fall within the operating costs as included in this, and also the split in the operating subsidy?
Yes, yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, yes.
All right. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Hausman, you had a question at this point, I believe.
Well, just because Representative Holberg was asking questions about this state and local, again, a question relative to equity, since we've also got a couple of bus lines on the drawing boards that we're moving forward on. On the administration proposal for operating cost responsibility, costs not covered by fares or federal dollars split 50% state, 50% local, we would apply that same formula to the two bus corridors that we are, we've got on the drawing boards. Would that be the administration's? And if not, why not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, I can't answer that question at this point. The governor's 50-50 proposal is for rail projects. It is not yet in terms of like a Cedar Avenue busway. The operation cost split on that has not been proposed yet by the governor. It may be 50-50. It may not. There may be different criteria that the governor selects in the future. I do know that the financial model that the governor is putting forth for the North Star commuter rail is a model that he believes should be consistently applied to other rail projects in the future. Both the analysis under the rigorous federal criteria, the 50-50 operational cost split, and the two-thirds, one-third capital cost split for other rail projects in the corridor. Bus projects, bus rapid transit, those type of projects that may come forward in the future, they may or may not carry different criteria and different proposals.
And Mr. Chair, I think taxpayers are listening, mm-hmm. and they would wonder, one, I thought I heard you say cost-benefit analysis is going to be part of every kind of project. We're going to treat all projects equally, whether they're highway, bus, or rail. Why would we apply a different measure to operating costs? And then, should a taxpayer in one region wonder why they would be treated differently than taxpayers in another region?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, until we know, I think, that is the case or part of the administration's proposal, I think we could hold off on that, answering that question until we, it's a hypothetical that probably is not to be answered at this point.
I think Representative Dorman had several bills and amendments last year that addressed that, shifting the cost back, but I don't think we want to go there today. Any further questions for Mr. McFarland? Oh, excuse me, Representative Hornstein. Didn't mean to ignore you.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again.
Oh, you really mean that.
Yeah. You're a good chair. Well, first of all, thank Representative Tingelstad for your hard work on this and the working group. I think that this isn't everything I would want, but it certainly appears to be, you know, at its first blush as a reasonable compromise, a reasonable middle ground that I hope we can really come to consensus on, you know, with the governor. I have a question about the cost effectiveness index and cost benefit analysis that was done. Are issues related to air quality and public health part of the equation when you consider the cost benefits and cost effectiveness?
Stephen.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think it's very important that we stress what the cost effectiveness indicator is and what it is not. It is not a benefit cost analysis in any way, shape, or form. It is a construct developed by the Federal Transit Administration that they use to evaluate projects nationally, the whole range of 190 New Starts projects against each other. And in my presentation, I will detail more of what that means. But the cost effectiveness threshold, as established by the FTA, is not a benefit cost analysis, as has been previously done on this and other projects. So it does not include things like air quality or environmental considerations.
Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few quick questions. On the BNSF negotiations, you did an estimate of operating costs. Does that build in a profit margin for them?
Mr. Chair and Representative, those are estimates of the operating costs, and some of those would include payments to the host railroad, which have not been fully discussed. And we will have a presentation at the end, Mr. Cliff Green,
okay,
who will more fully discuss the ongoing discussions with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe.
Okay, thank you. And one other question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that the cost-benefit analysis that for highway projects or for other things that MnDOT's putting into place, does that look more like the cost-benefit analyses we've seen before on this project as opposed to the CEI? Or can you give me a sense of where that type of analysis would come out on North Star?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes. It is more what we have in our state transportation statewide transportation plan is more akin to the more commonly understood cost-benefit analysis process that you put projects through to develop over a dollar, less than a dollar kind of cost-benefit type of analysis.
So it would be similar to kind of the things we saw last spring.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe unless there...
I had one more question, okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you've already covered this, I got in here late, or maybe you're going to cover this. Has there been analysis done to show that by having North Star in the corridor that there will be congestion relief at the intersections that are presently considered as congestion problems? And if so, based on what? Do you have criteria that you can show that in other areas of the country there has actually been a relief, and will there be relief as a proof to show that that's going to happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, to buttress my earlier comments to Representative Holberg, since the NCDA was the organization that did the modeling, did the study, not MnDOT, I'll turn that question over to Mr. Stevens again.
Mr. Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, yes, there have been studies. You mentioned intersections. There have been traffic studies and traffic analysis done at all of the station locations, because the expectation at the stations, when you bring a whole lot of cars into one particular area to park and then ride the train, the expectation would be that would present adverse consequences at those intersections. And as it turns out, we did not find that the arrival and departure of the people parking and riding were going to severely impact those intersections. And that's all documented in the draft and final environmental impact statements that were done for the entire project. The other part of the question that I think Representative Anderson was asking is, with the advent of the train, will congestion go away? And no, nobody's saying that with the advent of the train, congestion will be eliminated. However, you do need to consider that even with the reduced forecast of 5,600 trips per day, that is 2,600 trips in the AM and in the PM, and those cars will be removed from the roadway during the peak time. And it's the peak time, both morning and evening peak, where the traffic impact is the worst, where the congestion is the worst, and that's when the commuter trains operate, and so that's when they can provide the most relief to the roadway system.
Mr. Stevens, isn't some of the disagreement between you and Burlington Northern, I should say, NCDA, is the traffic intersections of the train and the number of trains going through these intersections during peak time and how they should be signalized, where there should be overpasses and so forth, because of the, you could also get to the point where you're causing more congestion because of the trains, the increased traffic on the track. Isn't that some of the disagreement with BNSF?
Mr. Chairman, once again, we think the BNSF has been extremely cooperative and we are having very fruitful discussions. Obviously, the railroad, anywhere across the country would prefer that there are no traffic impacts, that all crossings are grade separated. We don't see the impact on the railroad as being that significant, nor do I believe they do. The issue is at the crossings, at the stations, there are some very strict requirements for passengers crossing the railroad tracks, absolute reasonable concerns for safety, and there are some design standards that that need to be employed and that should be employed to protect the passengers both arriving in cars and on foot and on bicycle and on buses as they approach the transit stations. We have tried to locate all of the transit stations at intersections to provide that extra level of safety at crossings. And those, I think there's now two locations along the revised project that do not have stations at intersections. And in both of those cases, we provide pedestrian access to the transit platforms by pedestrian bridges, either over the railroad track or under the railroad track. So we absolutely eliminate the potential for train and pedestrian interaction.
Representative Anderson, any follow-up? Representative DeForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stevens, I wanted to follow up on Representative Anderson's question. Specifically, if North Star is implemented as proposed, what is the projected level of service on Highway 10 with respect to congestion as compared to what it might be if, say, a third lane was added in each direction through Big Lake? What's the difference?
The as I recall, the impact on the level of service as a result of the construction of the North Star commuter rail on Trunk Highway 10, it will not improve it a level of service grade, if everyone's familiar with level of service grades. What the impact would be of an additional lane on Trunk Highway 10, and you named the specific location, if you added a lane to Trunk Highway 10, it would likely improve the level of service at that particular location for some period of time. But true to form, most transportation analysts consider that capacity is a commodity and it'll be consumed just as it's been consumed on 494, on 35W, on Crosstown, on all of the routes. You provide capacity and the capacity is consumed. Because it's there, it gets used up.
Mr. McFarland was making a motion that he wanted
to Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForest, I want to also make clear as part of the governor's proposal or thinking on this project, that it is not the governor's position that the North Star commuter rail is a end-all solution to congestion in the two major highways in that corridor, Highway 10 and Interstate 94. It is one option. It is one tool, and it will not. It is not an either-or proposition. The governor believes in the future that highway improvements are important in the corridor, both on Highway 10 and on Interstate 94, and that this does not preclude the need for those improvements.
Ms. McFarland, then kind of a follow-up. Will the road projects in that area disappear or be delayed by 1, 5, 10 years because of the North Star?
Mr. Chairman, no.
So the investment in that corridor will be the same. It might be delayed by 1 year, but the investment in that corridor for road projects is going to have to be the same.
Mr. Chairman, any delays in road projects there would be for reasons other than the fact that that a commuter rail is being built. The commitment to improvements on roads in that corridor remains the same, and the governor's commitment to continuing to look for long-term funding solutions that would allow for improvements in that corridor and highway corridors throughout the region and the state continues.
So we're going to be spending the same amount of money in that corridor whether or not this rail line is built?
Mr. Chairman, yes. The need for the improvements remain.
Ms. McFarland, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just getting it on tape. Representative Deal Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up. Mr. Stevens, obviously this project is of some import to my district, and I just want to make sure we're absolutely clear about this, that you've said that if we were to build and implement North Star as it's proposed, we will see no improvement in the level of service on Highway 10.
Mr. Chairman and Representative De La Forest, I don't believe, and if I did, I did not mean to characterize it as that. What I tried to explain was that the commuter service serves primarily home-based work trips, which go in the AM and PM peak periods, and every person that's on the train that would otherwise be driving a car will be off the roadway during those peak periods when the roadways are most congested.
But, as I heard you say before, building North Star is not going to improve the service level by a letter grade. Is that true?
That's correct.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens and Ms. Richardson, I guess you're going to take the presentation. And before they start, I forgot to introduce at the beginning of the meeting. I did have a change in staff. I must be hard to work with. Becky Gervin is now the committee administrator, and Dan Miller is now the committee legislative assistant. And I'll guarantee you they'll be nicer to you than they are to me. So with that, Ms. Richardson, I think you'll find these two people would be of my staff be great to work with, so I'm hoping anyway. And they stick around at least through the session. Mr. Williams and Mr. Walls have stuck around, so I must not be all bad. Oh, you got job offers? Is that what you thought? I want to know the names. Ms. Richardson, are you going to lead off then, or okay? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Richardson, and I am a member of the North Star Corridor Development
Speak
Authority.
Speak directly into the mic. It's not quite carrying.
Okay.
But either that, the mic isn't up there. Okay.
Okay. I'm a member of the North Star Corridor's Development Authority's project management team, and I serve as the NCDA's legal counsel. As you all are aware, that North Star Corridor Development Authority is a joint powers board of 30 units of government that are located in the corridor between Minneapolis and Rice. My purpose here today is to provide you some background information about the Federal Transit Administration's process for evaluating and rating new starts projects or new fixed guideway projects like the North Star Commuter Rail. Ken Stevens, who is also part of the project management team, will describe how the FTA's approach for evaluating cost-effectiveness, the CEI index we've been talking about, and their approach for forecasting ridership has changed over the last year or so. He's also then going to discuss the modifications that we made to the North Star project in order to meet the FTA's threshold for cost-effectiveness and in order to stay competitive in the New Starts process. So stepping back just a little bit, in 1998, when the Congress enacted T21, Congress also required as a part of that law that the FTA make an annual report to Congress that includes a proposal for allocating New Starts funds and for rating and evaluating all of the projects that are competing for this New Starts pot of money. The funds are discretionary and are awarded on a competitive basis, and the way to compete on a national level is to go through this process that's prescribed in federal regulation. It's a pretty rigorous process and it's carefully defined. What I'd like to do is just kind of briefly give you an update on where North Star is in the process, the steps that have been completed, and what lies ahead. In 1998, the NCDA commenced a major investment study. This is now called an alternatives analysis. And in this study, you are required to define the transportation problem in the corridor and then look at all of the alternatives that could feasibly address the problem. In 1999, the NCDA selected the locally preferred strategy, which was a bundle of improvements to the corridor, the centerpiece of which is the commuter rail project that we're talking about. There were also proposals for highway improvements, river crossings, bike and pedestrian pathways, and so on. In 2000, the strategy for commuter rail was included in the St. Cloud Area Planning Organization's plans, the Metropolitan Council's plans, and MnDOT's transportation plans. This is a required step by the FTA. They want to ensure that all of the governing documents that relate to improvement of transportation reflect the proposed strategy. The next step in the process was the FTA had to give us their consent to enter into preliminary engineering and the draft environmental impact statement. I should note that the diamonds on this flow chart designate the steps where you need the FTA's approval. You need to submit information to the FTA so they can assess your project and determine whether they think the project is worthy enough to move forward. They did give us their consent in June of 2000 to begin preliminary engineering, and we completed the engineering in mid-year 2001. The EIS was completed at the end of 2002. I should note that right when we completed preliminary engineering in June of 2001, that's approximately when MnDOT took over management of the project. And that's the work that's been done to date under the New Starts process. This page delineates the steps that need to be completed under the New Starts process. As Mr. McFarland explained, the next step is the commitment of the non-federal funding. In order to get into final design, we need 50% of the non-federal funding committed before the FTA will approve a project entering into final design. If that is accomplished during this next session, we anticipate the FTA's consent would follow shortly thereafter. Final design would occur between 2004, 2005, and we discussed the elements that would happen during this period, the plans, the specs, and the right-of-way acquisition. In 2006, we anticipate then going to the FTA and requesting a full funding grant agreement. Again, this is the checkpoint for the state of Minnesota as well. It's a decision point for the project moving ahead. Once that is accomplished, construction and vehicle procurement will be completed over the period of 2006 through 2008, and operations will begin in 2008. What I would like to do is just spend a little bit of time talking about how the FTA evaluates projects and determines whether a project can move forward through this process, New Starts process. What they attempt to do is create a level playing field across the country and require each project to submit the same type of information. And it, the FTA then applies the same criteria and measures projects using the same measurements across the country. A project is recommended to move forward in the process based on two general overall ratings, a project finance rating and a project justification rating. Under the project finance rating, the FTA looks at the commitment of the non-federal funds, the capital finance plan, and the operating finance plan. Under the project justification rating, and this is where we'd like to focus today, the FTA looks at mobility benefits, environmental benefits, operating efficiency, cost effectiveness, and supporting land use. The project justification criteria that I just mentioned are measured by a number of detailed and technical analyses that are listed on this sheet. I won't go over them, but again, these are the measures that are required of projects across the country. The FTA evaluates New Starts projects for a number of purposes. As I mentioned on the flow chart, projects that want to advance into preliminary engineering or final design must submit the information to the FTA and get their approval. The FTA assigns ratings on an annual report to Congress, and so the information must be submitted annually to the FTA. FTA uses the information to develop its funding recommendations for the administration's annual budget request to Congress. And again, the information is used to determine eligibility for a full funding grant agreement. To review with you quickly then, the FTA has been rating the North Star project since the year 2000. In 2000, FTA gave us a recommended rating and approved our entry into preliminary engineering. In 2001, we received a recommended rating in the annual report to Congress. In 2002, again, we were recommended and cited as one of five meritorious projects in the country. And it is unique that we were included in the President's budget for several million dollars. Typically, projects aren't in the President's budget until they have a full funding grant agreement. But then in 2003, North Star received a not recommended rating due to the lack of the commitment of the non-federal fundings. This is a letter, an excerpt of a letter from the FTA to Commissioner Molnow relating to the not recommended rating that that North Star received in 2003. The highlighted language says that the not recommended rating is due to MnDOT's and the NCDA's inability to secure the requisite financial commitment from the Minnesota legislature for the project. So our rating of not recommended was primarily due to the financial assessment. In the interim, however, the FTA has now changed the measures for assessing projects and whether they meet their evaluation criteria. And in particular, the cost effectiveness criteria has changed significantly since the North Star proceeded through the process. The old approach under cost effectiveness was to focus on new transit riders. Under the new approach, there's more of an efficiency standard, and the FTA is looking at travel time savings for all transit riders. And what we'd like to do is take this opportunity to have Ken Stevens to discuss this cost effectiveness index in a little bit more detail so you understand what we're talking about and this $25 threshold. Mr. Chair?
Mr. Stevens, I will try to save questions until the end again. It's the chair's wish to try to get out of here by the 11 for everybody's sake. If we have questions, we'll try to get them in that time. If not, we'll try to we'll stay extra time. We'll be having more hearings on this once session starts, but we thought we'd at least get some questions on the table today. Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go through this as quickly as I can. The FTA new approach to measuring cost effectiveness, and the theory is that we try to maximize the travel time savings while minimizing the capital and operating cost. And that leads, what we're trying to do then is annualize the total project cost. And that, by annualizing, what that means is if you have part of the system, such as the rail, the track, that's going to last 100 years or more, Rail cars, according to the FTA guidelines, we can attribute a 25-year life to those. Each of the improvements has a different lifespan. What we try and do is bring the capital cost back to an annualized capital cost. We then also add the annual operating and maintenance costs. So we have a cost of this project per year on an annualized basis. What we need to compare that with is that same annualized cost of a very good bus service, or a bus service that would mimic the rail service that's being proposed. In this case, we used the North Star commuter coach kind of service, and we ran that service so it would be similar as the rail service from Big Lake to Minneapolis. So what we do then is find the difference between the annualized cost of the proposed project, the commuter rail project, between that and this really very good commuter coach bus service that we could envision operating on this corridor, to find out our incremental cost. And then we look at and try and measure the estimated time savings that could be attributable to riding on the commuter rail project versus riding on the bus or other modes of transit. And when we do that, we do the arithmetic, we have an annualized cost over an incremental travel time savings to develop a number that's a cost per hour of travel time saved. And that becomes the threshold that is established by the Federal Transit Administration, once again, to evaluate projects against other projects across the country. All projects across the country have to use the same criteria and develop a same cost per hour of travel time saved. And that travel time saved, once again, is the difference between the travel time for all people using the commuter rail versus the travel time that they would expend if they were to use this new best bus system. And by the way, our calculations do all include, as Representative Holberg asked previously, they do include the $32 million for the LRT connection at downtown Minneapolis. As we evaluate the travel time savings on the commuter rail, the number that we come up that goes into actually our denominator for this calculation, we are estimating that we'll save over 892,000 hours per year. That's kind of the approach to the FTA's cost effectiveness indicator, and was asked previously also, does that include the environmental benefits? And my answer was no. But as you saw, as Mary went through her evaluation, there are a whole host of other criteria, one of which does include the environmental benefits. So environmental benefits are considered, they're just not considered in this cost effectiveness index. I'd like to spend just a couple minutes on the FTA's new approach to ridership forecasting. As Mr. McFarland indicated, our earlier forecast was for 10,800 trips per day. That was based on the 1990 census. As we updated that on the basis of the legislative direction using the same model, that would have grown to 15,800 trips per day. The reason that we discovered for that growth using that old model was because it turns out the number of trips from this corridor into the CBD is actually anywhere from 60% greater up in the St. Cloud area to 80 to 100% greater than was forecast under the 1990 census. So the number of trips from within the corridor to the CBD have greatly exceeded the number of trips that were used in the old forecasting method. Having said that, the FTA will no longer allow that same methodology in forecasting the travel demand. One of the, and I hope I don't lose everybody here, but the biggest factor in the change from the old to the new FTA process is in how people choose which mode of travel they would take. And in forecasting, there are two major issues. One is you have to determine the total person trips, the number of people that live within this corridor, how many people live within the corridor, where do they go, what kind of trips do they make, and things that enter into that are their origin, obviously, with respect to the stations and the corridor in general, their destination, where do they work, in this case, principally, how many work within the corridor or, generally speaking, downtown in Minneapolis, and what is their trip purpose. And for commuter rail, the biggest impact on ridership is how many people live within the corridor and would take this during the peak commuting times for their work trip. How many people within this corridor work downtown is essentially the question. And then after you try and understand that, then you want to know, of all of those people, how many would choose commuter rail as their mode. And in picking your mode choice, things that you look at are the fares for the competing modes, the bus or the commuter rail, the travel time on the roadways, in the bus or in the commuter rail, the parking costs, when you get to your destination, what are they, how do they feed into this computer model, auto operating costs. And while we hear and have often been quoted as the AAA number of 48 cents per mile to operate your automobile and so forth, the number that the FTA allows and that forecasters use for auto operating costs is roughly 10 cents a mile. And that's to cover gas and oil and tires and batteries, and that's it. No auto ownership cost is in here, no insurance cost, none of that. So those are the things that go into the model to calculate, of all the people who live here and want to travel within the corridor to a destination served by this, how many would choose commuter rail to make that trip if it were available. In the prior forecast, we used a methodology that was developed when MnDOT first started looking at commuter rail options in the Twin Cities metro area. The Metropolitan Council model, which is used to develop these forecasts, does not have a choice for commuter rail, and that's simply because there is no commuter rail in the metro area. Previously, we could use a process called stated preference survey. You would sample people within the corridor and say, given these conditions, if a fare was X, if it took you so long to travel, if it was available, what method would you choose? And we could then take that sample size and extrapolate that to the people within the corridor and say, given all this travel, these are the numbers of people that would choose commuter rail if it was available. The FTA, under their current rules, no longer allow that process. While they do allow it in cities that do have commuter rail, because they can say, the cities such as the East Coast, for instance, Chicago, that have extensive commuter rail operations, they can say, look, we demonstrated this does replicate people's behavior in these cities with commuter rail. They will choose commuter rail at a higher rate than, say, a bus or other modes. Here, however, we can no longer use that. We have to treat the commuter rail mode just the same as we would treat a bus, and it boils down to service levels and travel time savings. So that is, in essence, why our forecast has gone from the 10,008 up to the 15,008. That's anecdotal information. The number that we are using within our FTA analysis is 5,600. Now, the question was, how has the project changed as a result of meeting the cost effectiveness threshold? Once again, things that we wanted to do when we looked at the project from Rice to downtown Minneapolis, it clearly exceeded the threshold limits, and it seemed beyond reason to conclude that we could ever make it fit within the threshold limits. So we started looking at ways to speed up the train, which would provide greater travel time savings to everyone on it, and would contribute to our equation. We also wanted to reduce costs and therefore reduce the numerator of this equation. So we eliminated the station at Rice. We eliminated the station at St. Cloud. We eliminated the station at Becker. And incidentally, we then eliminated the station at Northeast Minneapolis. We started by looking at the lowest ridership stations on the system. And we eliminated those four stations. That had the impact of speeding the travel and reducing the capital cost. One of the anomalies about this new forecasting method is the station at Foley Boulevard. You can see it's the blue box, that's the fourth station up from downtown Minneapolis. As we looked at this process, and we again are trying to find travel time savings, when we looked at the comparison between the bus service between Foley Boulevard and the proposed commuter rail service, it turns out there is excellent bus service from the existing Foley Boulevard park and ride lot. There's a direct slip ramp from the park and ride lot onto Trunk Highway 610. The shoulders on Trunk Highway 252 are all improved to allow shoulder bus operation on those. So when the traffic backs up at the lights, the bus can move over onto the shoulder. That service is very efficient. When we compared the rail speeds to the bus speeds, it was determined that the bus would beat the rail by 2 minutes. If we did stop at the Foley Boulevard station because of our FTA requirement to meet this threshold, we would incur a disbenefit of 2 minutes for every passenger because theoretically the bus can beat the train by 2 minutes. And so it was incumbent on us, because we have been cooperating with the FTA, because everybody's very sincere about having an absolute critical review by the FTA on this process. The results of that analysis have led us to conclude that we should eliminate the Foley Boulevard station. In our prior forecast, that was over 2,000 trips on the commuter train that's going to be going right past this station now. That's somewhat illogical from our local perspective, but it was a necessary step to avoid having a disbenefit in our modeling process and the FTA evaluation. So we ultimately eliminated the Foley Boulevard station, even in the face of our fairly robust ridership from that station, just to satisfy the FTA requirements. The current project then is 40 miles from Big Lake to downtown Minneapolis. The ridership is 5,600. The capital cost in fiscal 2008 dollars are $232.6 million for the commuter rail, and the LRT connection is $32.4 million. Operating costs, including the light rail connection, is $10.4 million per year. Travel time from Big Lake to downtown is 43 minutes, giving us a cost effectiveness indicator of 24.72. On the next slide, you can see the distribution of costs. I think Mr. McFarland went over that pretty completely. It's in fiscal year 2008 dollars, and it is based on the four-car trains. And on that slide, you see the distribution of the funding sources. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Stevens, my earlier questions was related to what the savings were by eliminating the 40 miles of track improvements, the stations that were eliminated, what the cost of both the right-of-way and the stations, okay, and what savings they were.
Okay, I can tell you that the Rice to Minneapolis, the capital cost in 2007 dollars is roughly $318 million. And Big Lake to Minneapolis is roughly, well, it's $265 million. So that's $52 million. For the stations that I listed throughout the the corridor, including Northeast Minneapolis and Foley?
Something's not adding up. You're saying there was a savings by eliminating that 40 miles of track in those five stations was $52 million of savings?
That's approximately correct. And understanding that the track, of course, isn't what is eliminated, but the stations themselves are eliminated, and there are some improvements that are within that territory that Mr. McFarland alluded to earlier that are eliminated as well.
So the figure 50% of that is state and local share, that's $26 million. Why didn't the cost of the project drop $26 million?
The cost of the project has dropped, what we are estimating here is $265 million in 2008 dollars for the cost of the project. That's the current estimate in 2008 dollars is $265 million.
I believe you were asking for $133 million last year, and you're at $131 now. Why isn't the numbers... In fact, there was $123 million last year. What is the difference there?
I'm not sure I'm tracking with you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Stevens, the previous estimates for this track, why it has grown, has been, I believe last year, was somewhere between $123 and $130 million. We're still at $131 million, but we knocked off $26 million. Why isn't there a reduction of $26 million?
Part of it, Mr. Chairman, part of it could be in the addition of a year's inflation. We are now talking in...
That's 20% inflation.
No. The inflation rate is 2.7% per year on the total capital cost. There has been some revision on the shares based on the LRT connection, but that should only reduce the state's portion.
Representative Dingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question may relate to the last slide there where it gives us state portion of it. As noted in last session, the request was $123 million of the state bonding. This year, the request would be $88 million in state bonding. There's been an adjustment with a local share, but I think you see that the state share has gone down appropriately with this project.
Representative Tinglestead, you add the two numbers up of the state and local share, you're still at $131.5 million, I believe I saw somewhere here. Last year we were at $123 million. We lost 40 miles of track and five stations. We're going the wrong way.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, that did not include the local share last year. The 123 was just the state share of it. Did not include the 10% the locals were looking at that point.
And that would have been $12 million?
What was
it? Mr. Chairman, $23
million? Last year,
correct.
Representative Leader, you had a question earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stevens, I'm kind of surprised with your cost-effective index. When you analyze your baseline cost compared to rail and bus, now, in rail, you take care of the signals and you take care of the infrastructure, but in bus, unless something changes, they don't pay gasoline tax or diesel fuel tax, or they don't pay for their infrastructure. Now, how can you relate those two costs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leader, the FTA does not consider those operating costs. They do not consider the cost of the infrastructure the buses run on. What they do consider is the cost of bus stations, park and rides, for instance. They do also consider the buses themselves, and they assign a useful life of a bus at 12 years for purposes of this analysis. But there's some of those other costs are simply not included in the FTA's analysis. Do you are correct, the rail stuff, and it all has differing time frames. And those time frames are dictated by the FTA formula.
Representative Leader, you have a follow-up?
No, it appears to me it's really unbalanced because there's a heck of a lot of difference in cost of building a mile of rail compared to the bus getting a free ride on the infrastructure.
Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stevens, you had mentioned in a previous slide a savings of about 892,000 hours, I believe it was, a year. Help me break that down. You know, in a constituent of mine in central Anoka County, you know, every day on their commute and their drive to downtown Minneapolis, how much time are they going to save roughly because of North Star?
I would, Mr. Chairman and Representative DeLaForest, I absolutely have to preface this by saying these calculations we are in the process of refining for FTA. Our schedule to get them to FTA is February 1. We've worked really hard on this cost effectiveness stuff to the extent of some of the other numbers, but I can tell you a preliminary number, if you'll treat it as such, is actually 1.4 minutes saved per mile traveled.
Thank you.
It doesn't make sense.
That would seem high, but that's why I couch it as being a preliminary number.
1.4 million.
1.4 minutes
per mile traveled.
Right. So if your trip was 20 miles, you would save 28 minutes.
I'll treat that as preliminary. Thanks.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, that is a standing still. Or is that what the attempt is trying to?
Mr. Chair, that's why I had to absolutely assert that it was a preliminary number, and we are looking at all of these numbers as we prepare to submit them to FTA. There's a great deal of detail, as you might imagine, even in the forecasting and the calculation of the travel time saved versus the baseline. And then there are a number of the other criteria, as Mary pointed out, that need to be assembled for submittal to FTA.
Well, it just seems to me that you're expecting the train to average 80 miles per hour with those numbers and everybody else be standing still in traffic, which might be logical, but it doesn't seem like that train will make that kind of speed. And my calculations could be off.
Mr. Chair, since you brought it up, the average, the speed of the train can travel at speeds up to 79 miles per hour on this corridor, but the average speed between Big Lake and downtown Minneapolis, the average speed over that course is 54 miles per hour.
Representative Holberg, you are next.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can you tell me in your modeling what you're using for your end destination? My understanding now is you've got a commuter bus running that actually goes right downtown, and that if this project comes to be, a commuter would get on their station, would get on the commuter train, would have to get off, get on the link to the LRT, and then get off that and get on a circulator bus to get downtown Minneapolis. So do you, when you model this, do you take it to their end destination, including all of those transfers, or do you do it just to the end of the line, or the commuter line, the end of the light rail extension?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holder, you have picked up on one of the issues that does affect ridership. There are huge penalties that are built into the model for transfers, and we do consider the folks that are traveling on the North Star commuter rail and the transfer to light rail for distribution or trips further on, as a matter of fact. The current commuter bus does stop at the Fifth Street parking garage, which is the terminus for the North Star commuter rail as well, the parking area behind the Target Center. But our modeling does consider the walk time, access to and from, and it includes transfers and transfer penalties and waiting time. If you'll recall my Foley Boulevard example, it's one of the reasons, an additional reason that we incur such huge disbenefits, and that is because the commuter service is 30 minutes and the bus schedule is 6.5 minutes. And so the model treats that as a huge penalty for commuter riders because they would have to wait so long for the next train, when in reality, people are not going to show up 30 minutes ahead of the next train. They're soon going to determine the pattern and show up 5 minutes before it leaves. But the fact is, we incur a huge disbenefit because of 30-minute service as opposed to 6.5-minute service that's currently there.
Mr. Stevens, is the plan to have buses at the circulated buses at the end of the North Star, or do they have to take a link to the LRT to get to the, where the buses are circulating?
Mr. Chairman, the platform for the North Star commuter rail will be directly below the platform for light rail transit. So there will be a simple stairs, elevator access from one story down below the bridge level to light rail that's on the bridge one story above. So it's a very simple transfer from that point. The 5th Street parking garage is a short block walk where most of the buses from the East Metro come in and circulate and transfer people throughout the Twin Cities system. But additionally, what's been experienced in many other cities and what we expect to happen here are private coaches. Businesses will develop their own system to meet the trains to handle their employees to and from work. Very much like the Northwest Athletic Club does now, with the commuter coach circulating through town to pick up their customers to take to their business. It's very much in evidence in commuter systems across the country.
But there's the question then, how many people, if they didn't have to get on to get to the circulated bus, would be traveling on the LRT? Has that number been thought of? Because it seems to me you just have the buses go to the end of the North Star instead of building the link between the two. It doesn't seem to me that there'd be that many people transferring. Has that been estimated?
Mr. Chair, I do not know what that number is, but I do know that the LRT extension has been considered in the forecasting model. I don't know what the number of people who would move on to LRT. There's also another very important mode that I didn't mention, and that's simply walking. A lot of people work in the warehouse district. A lot of people, you can get access now to the Skyway system from the parking garages, and you can access that all the way over to the East Metro should you choose to walk.
Mr. Chair, if I might, one additional question, and it's related to the policy of the NCDA. Is there a policy of disclosure of business interests or land holdings in this corridor for members of NCDA, contractors, lobbyists? Do we have any way of knowing what people's business interests are in this corridor that work on this project?
Mr. Chair, the NCDA is in the process of requesting that information from all of its contractors. The elected officials that sit on the NCDA are obligated under the conflict of interest laws to disclose that type of conflict under the law, but we are in the process of gathering that information and can make a report back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Going through this, and maybe this was already mentioned in earlier testimony, or anyway, it's you in the first square here that I think Ms. Richardson was going over. Says funds are discretionary from the feds. How long, what time period is it that we have available in obtaining these discretionary funds from the feds for this project?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Richardson.
Could it stay under NCDA guidelines, or who? I mean, I guess that you're saying then that the state's going to manage the North Star Corridor.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it was a requirement of state law in, I think it was 1999, the state legislature passed a law that gave MnDOT the sole authority to develop commuter rail. It did authorize MnDOT to delegate that responsibility to a joint powers board like the North Star Corridor Development Authority. But in 2001, MnDOT decided that they would prefer to develop the North Star Commuter Rail, and the NCDA's role as a project sponsor was then diminished.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Another PowerPoint tutorial, you're talking about costs and stuff. What is the total number of dollars spent on the North Star Commuter Rail from the beginning of this project to the present? Do you have statistics or do you have data that can show how much it was spent and where it was spent? And I was wondering if we could see that information.
Mr. Chair, we do not have that available for you today, but we can certainly get it for you.
Thank you. And one follow-up, last follow-up.
Representative Anderson.
You mentioned, Mr. Stevens mentioned, Mr. Richardson, that the NCDA or the North Star Corridor had to meet a threshold set by the FTA. And I'm wondering what that threshold was based on, if you could give some specifics on that. And if by chance this thing is approved, if you or the state wants to add the eliminated portion of the route here from Rice to Becker, does the threshold now change? Because right now, my understanding is the threshold is from was designed based on the information you gave to the feds from Rice to Minneapolis. They said, no, that's not going to work. You redid your figures and found out that in order to meet their guidelines, the amount of money I'm thinking that they're requiring, that you had to go down to from Big Lake to northeast Minneapolis. Does the threshold change now if you want to add on to Rice?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, no, the threshold stays the same. The threshold, once again, is based on the incremental cost of the commuter rail project as opposed to the best bus we could imagine here that mimics commuter rail divided by the travel time savings, and that number needs to be around $25. Once again, the threshold established by FTA is $25 per hour of travel time saved for your project, whatever its limits may be. And once again, as Mr. McFarland indicated, that's a guidance line for them. It is not an absolute, but it's a guidance for them that they use together with all the other criteria that Mary mentioned to give you a rating on your project.
What was the CEI going up to, right?
It was very high. It was
about St. Cloud.
To St. Cloud, it was about $3.50 more. To Rice, it was significantly higher.
But still well over the $25.
Well over the $25.
Representative Anderson?
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stevens, and for the add-on of Big Lake to Rice, that threshold is still going to be the $25, and right now, it doesn't look even feasible that it could even happen. I mean, even if we came up with the Big Lake to Minneapolis situation, that going future 10 years, that you're even going to be able to come up with meeting the requirements of the threshold presently.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, any project extensions, if they were separate projects, would be evaluated on their own merits using the same criteria. And that is incremental cost over travel time savings. So if that were to be a future project, it would be evaluated independently on its own merits.
But Mr. Stevens, it's unlikely, given the numbers that we see before us, that the feds would participate in a line to St. Cloud if they are under the same criteria they are now.
Correct.
And it's probably more likely that any additional commuter rail service would probably go elsewhere where the numbers are better in the metropolitan area, such as what's the one by the southeast? Red Rock. That's more likely to get federal funding than going to St. Cloud.
Mr. Chair, I'm not familiar with the numbers on the Red Rock, nor have we you know, done an independent evaluation, as Representative Hausman indicated, some of the things that change with respect to a separate line would be the fact that the maintenance facility is already in place, for instance.
Any further? Oh, Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, thanks. On the other criteria other than cost effectiveness, there's fire. Are there documentation of that stuff that you have? I mean, are there reports or?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Can we get copies of those before next week?
Mr. Chair, we have the DE, the draft environmental impact statement, the final environmental impact statement, and the New START submittals, and we can provide you the stack of documents, which is about this high, but it's certainly available to you.
Representative Thiessen, I had hoped to get into how the local costs would be implemented, what kind of taxes they were looking at, property, sales tax, or whatever. Courtesy to NCDA, I decided not to do that today because they have only had this for a week, but I would hope before session that they have those numbers, and so we, the taxpayers in that district, along the route, and how the cost share, if they're going to require still St. Cloud to pay for some of this initial cost or whatever, how that's all going to work out. So hopefully we'll have some more information before we take this up again. Probably the first week or second week in session. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on Representative Thiessen's question, some of that information has come to us from other groups. And we've talked a lot today about time saved, but I know some of the groups that have advocated for transportation choices in this region have shown us the national studies and our comparisons where our commuters have to pay far more for transportation than any comparable region across the country because we're auto-dependent and all of those having to buy a car and gas and insurance, etc., plus parking at their destination. And when they compare us to all other regions, our traveling public has to pay far more compared to other. I think we have to remember who we're serving, and we're not serving government, we're serving people who want to move, and we do have to get more complex in our understanding. Time is one, cost to that traveler is another, and those things should matter to us as we think about, and I should care just as much as Representative De La Forest does about his constituents and how much it costs them to go to work. But it is a complex picture, and when we zero in with kind of laser-like specificity on one piece, we just forget the complex picture. And so you've listed a little bit of it in that chart that he mentioned, but there are even more that we've seen before us. You almost have to remember, your mind has to have a memory for everything you've heard in the last 10 years here in committee and put it all together to be fair to our citizens of Minnesota.
But Representative Hausman, there's no funding mechanism in place to fund any of these projects. It's all general fund appropriation. And that's my major concern, is that we don't have it to begin with, and that we need to look at the funding mechanisms. Somebody's going to have to take that tough vote sometime or another, and the governor's going to have to lead on that. And also, the taxpayers along this route are going to be asked to bear some of the brunt of this, which means that it's the same taxpayers and the same tax dollars competing for education dollars and so forth. So there is a lot of questions to be asked on this project and how it's going to be paid for. And it's better to do it up front than end up like the RRT, where we basically said to Hennepin County, pony up 50%. I don't think that's the right way to do it. I think it's better to have it up front, contracts and agreements signed before we start acting on it. Representative Tingle said you had a Mr. Green that wanted to do a, can you be brief, or is it going to take longer than that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Green, I don't want to cut you short, but the committee's time, how long is your presentation?
Mr. Chair, I can make it as short as you absolutely need it to be.
Why don't you make it short? We'd be more than happy to have you come back at a later date and do more if you wish.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. My
name is Mr. Green.
It's Cliff Green, and my role in this process has been to assist the NCDA and the Burlington Northern Santa Fe in getting back to dialogue so that we can generate a consensus and final capital improvements number. That's my role.
Mr. Green, are you the one that has been hired by MnDOT and NCDA to negotiate with Burlington Northern?
Your Honor, I'm so used to being in court. I would say yes, with this one caveat, that the approach that we are using in this process is not a positional negotiation approach. We're not being adversaries with Burlington Northern, saying this is your number, this is our number. Rather, what we are doing is we are taking a partnership approach, because we recognize that when this process is over, we will be operating in partnership with Burlington Northern. And I would just like, as a headline matter, to point out that I have been extremely impressed with the good faith and the professionalism of Burlington Northern Santa Fe and their willingness to try to make this project work during the resumption of these discussions. We have gone down to their headquarters in Fort Worth. We've had an opportunity to meet with people who have run these commuter lines in Chicago. We have an empathy for the issues that are behind their proposed projects. And so exploring this together, taking advantage of additional years of actual hard numbers rather than estimates, being able to figure out, are there other solutions that we can come up with working together, we are going to try to have a final number that will enable us to get to the final design stage. Our goal is obviously to come up with a complete consensus with Burlington Northern Santa Fe. But we have a time constraint, and the time constraint for me is the middle of March, perhaps late March. And if at that point we have narrowed the differences to a point that is bridgeable during the final design phase, where people can figure out ways to realize economies without compromising the interests of the railroad or the cost efficiency of this particular project, then we can say we are so close we can go to the next phase. So I wanted to introduce myself and make sure that the chair and the rest of the committee understands that we are hard at work, that we are very impressed with the professionalism and the can-do attitude of Burlington Northern Santa Fe. We are trying to reciprocate with that same approach, and we're optimistic that we're going to be able in just a couple months' time to have a number that is a final consensus number that we can present. So I hope that's short enough. There's more to say, perhaps at another time. Perhaps you'll invite me back to report on progress.
Thank you. Representative Tingle said, when do you think the local, how the locals are going to be paying for this will be coming up, and will it be before the county boards and others take action in support of it? Will they know how they're paying for it, or would they be just voting in the dark? I shouldn't say it that way, but basically just giving an approval, hoping to figure out a way to pay for it later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of the groups will be looking at this over the next few weeks. Certainly some of those organizations only meet once every 2 weeks, once a month, those types of things in those local government units. And so certainly, I'm sure, as an elected official, they'll be looking at this issue with their eyes wide open, and we'll hear their appropriate comments at that time, Mr. Chair, and be happy to share all that in a package.
Will it be within the next 2 weeks that we'll be able to know how they're paying for this? Or?
Mr. Chair, the main organization, the NCDA, will be meeting very soon, and we'll have that information to you.
And that will be stipulating where it will be property tax, asking for a sales tax from the legislature, local option sales tax, I should say, or exactly what that proposal will be.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is all those issues are being discussed. It might be appropriate for Tim Yontos from the MCDA to respond directly, but when the governor looked at this package, he offered flexibility to the locals, and certainly we'll be looking at all the different options.
Representative De La Force, I know, wants to know how much he's going to be paying out of his pocket.
As an Andover taxpayer, the same amount will come out of my pocket, Mr. Chair.
Too much was coming out of my pocket.
Oh, property tax, she's got a better house.
We won't get into that. Any further questions or comments? Representative Hausman.
I'm just wondering, you said our next meeting will be a joint meeting, and we're looking at this whole system, and I think, everything I know about transportation in the state says we've got a governance crisis then, because somebody has to come before this committee and talk about how this whole transit overlay is going to work. But as nearly as I can tell, we don't have a governance structure that can sit up there and do that. I mean, one of the things that we heard is that we've got, that MnDOT took over the management of this project, but we've got a commissioner who doesn't support it. They have to work in conjunction with the Met Council, whose very existence apparently is in jeopardy this legislative session. If I were the business community in this state, I would rise to arms here, because you're going to be asking a group of people to come and say how a transit system works in this region, and there's not a governance structure to do it. So I just, you know, it might be a great opportunity to show the crisis we're in this state if we don't get our act together in transportation planning.
Representative Hausman, you had to get him started. Look at that. I'm ready to adjourn. You had to get him started. Representative Hausman, I think the intent of the meeting next week is to look at all those. We have high-speed rail to Chicago. We have, you know, our LRT extensions. I don't know if we're going to talk about bus rapid transit or not, but there's a whole lot of things out there that are, you know, you're exactly right. We haven't put them all on the picture and know what we're looking at. So, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did hear Representative Hausman in an earlier dissertation there talk about an integrated planning overall system for transportation in the state, and I raised my hand, but you were too busy thinking about the parts that you and Representative Krenke are going to be looking at. It's fine to look at the parts, but we still do not have, as you so eloquently just said, an overall transportation system for this state that anybody is in the mood to even think about it, apparently, much less the governance, as Representative Hausman is talking about. So we can keep looking at the parts and end up with parts. Thank you.
And everything's got a price tag. With that,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kindleson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick closing comment. Appreciate the committee's time today. And as Mr. McFarland from MnDOT started out the presentation today, the governor has scrutinized this project thoroughly. It's gone through a lot of rigorous overview, and I appreciate the rigorous overview of this committee, and I'm hopeful that at the end of session we'll have the bonding of about $37.5 million for this project. Thank you for your consideration.
The governor may have scrutinized it. I see a lot of the track missing, and we're going to have to fill it in. So that the committee stands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next Tuesday is the joint hearing at 10 o'clock.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not going to throw it away, are they?